Say What Podcast is brought to you in partnership with Speak Studios and Speak Boise. Speak Boise is a community-driven studio space where voices from all walks of life can speak and be heard.
You can find them on Instagram and Facebook at Speak Studios, Speak Boise, and their website, speakstudios.com. Speak Studios.
Speak and be heard.
This podcast is also brought to you by Instant Imprints. Promote better with Instant Imprints. Instant Imprints are Boise's visual communication experts and your place for everything you need to promote your business, club, school, or group. As a locally owned business, Instant Imprints specializes in making your organization more visible with custom branded apparel, embroidery, promotional items, print services, and a wide format printing for signs as well as banners and vehicle graphics. Want better ways to get noticed? Visit Instant Imprints at instantimprints.com/Boise or call 208-IMPRINT. That's 208-467-7468.
Hey, it's Janessa.
And I'm Katie.
And this is
Say What?
Hey guys, we're back finally. Katie is not here again, so I brought in my lovely husband, Alan. We're going to do a little Q&A with him. He's got a fun story, and he's done a lot of cool things. I mean, I think at least in my opinion. We'll kind of talk about how we met and all that good stuff. So do you want to introduce yourself?
How's it going? My name is Alan Dade. No, I'm not trying to replace Katie when she hears this. All right. I'm just merely a guest, pretty much.
He does have that radio voice, though, right? I mean, I think like that deep. You could do like voiceovers. I think you can tell that all the time.
Good. I'm looking for a career change that will work.
So he's a teacher here in the not Boise School District, but just outside of that. So we'll leave it at that. I'm going to ask some questions and then you can kind of ask me questions if you want to, but I guess we'll get started. We do have our son in here. So if you hear little noises, we didn't have anybody to watch him. So he's here on an iPad entertaining
himself.
Story
of our life.
Okay. So for you, what is like one of the most memorable childhood moments?
Like just in general or
I mean like something that you love that reminds you of your childhood that's like a really good memory of your childhood.
Summers riding rollerblades around pretty much like 5th grade to 8th grade years just outside all the time. BMX bikes, building bikes, rollerblading, swimming. That was I'd say definitely summertime.
Yeah, well, because he's real active, like our son, and they just like to go. So, yeah, that's a good memory. I think mine was the same thing, just being out of school, hanging out with your friends, like swimming in your friend's pool, the long days. I mean, here the days are like way longer because we both grew up in California. So the sun sets at like a normal hour there, but here it's like, you know, till 10 o'clock. So I don't know. Our kids are going to have really good memories.
Yeah. All the extra light.
Yeah.
Can't beat it.
So, we're, like we said, you're a teacher, and I know you've always wanted to be a teacher. So do you want to kind of like talk about what influenced that decision? And then I have a question to kind of go on, piggyback on that.
So I have two teachers, I guess, through the years of education, you know, that you got to go through kindergarten to 12th grade, Mrs. Reck and Mrs. Hensley were the only two teachers that actually like cared, I guess.
What grades were they?
7th and 8th grade. But they were cool, but high school was the kind of decision maker of that I wanted to be a teacher because there was just duds, I guess. Like these people were in the position to change someone's life. And I wasn't the best student in the world. I was a knucklehead. Are we allowed to cuss?
No? Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was an asshole.
Our son has headphones on.
I know,
case,
yeah.
So
yeah, earmuffs. Good. Earmuffs. I was an asshole student, but I was just waiting for that one teacher, like specifically in high school, to pull me aside and be like, hey, like, you're an asshole. Like, let's try and change that. But there wasn't one. And so from then on, it was like, man, these people in the position to change someone's life, and they're not doing it, I guess. And that kind of, that's why I wanted to be a teacher, just to be that guy on campus, and just get that one letter from a student saying, hey, thanks for being, you know, energetic and changing my life. And I really appreciate that. And I've gotten those letters before, and it kind of just keeps you back into it, because you lose track of that, getting parent emails of complaints and all this kind of stuff. The negative always outweighs the positive. But, yeah, just getting those letters and just the students that say they appreciate you pretty much is huge, because then that means you've impacted their life in a positive way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, being your wife, I've seen that. And, like, I've seen the kids, and I've talked to the parents, and he does things differently. So he's a PE teacher, but, like, it's all very interactive. He's always keeping the kids in motion. It's not, you know, like, sit down and let's learn about PE. It's let's get out there and let's do fun things that can kind of include everybody. So, yeah, I've seen some of the really cool letters, and it's amazing to see the transition. But I do have to say, from like a parent's perspective, being married to a teacher and then having our own kids, I think people, and I don't know if it's just our generation, maybe it's always been like this, but I think parents need to take more ownership of what their responsibility is versus putting it all on the teacher. So, you know, because you have, I've seen some of the parent emails where, you know, their kids can't do this because, I don't know, the sun is shining too bright. I mean, the shit that they say sometimes is just crazy. But these kids need to move. I mean, I think it's like the highest rate of childhood obesity with these kids. And the lack of movement, and maybe just being on video games or being indoors all the time, it's just, it's kind of sad to see. But I think that it's on the flip side, seeing the impact that you make with these kids is amazing. So
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So he has taught middle school, high school, elementary school. What's your favorite? I know, but you could share with everybody else.
No, I know. Yeah. Last year was high school, and the age of kids is great. The only thing about high school is the schedule sucks, or I think I'd still be there. But it's middle school for sure is where it's at. Like, the kids are just at that age where they can take your sarcasm. But they're also at that age where they're still excited to be there at school. They haven't really made up their minds yet on what they want to do with life or whether they're going to be an asshole student or not, pretty much.
Because asshole students aren't always the bad ones. They're just,
oh, no, they're,
you
great.
Know, like, they need to move. They need someone to recognize their strengths, yeah, and how to, like, teach them based off of that.
Well, they just want that one teacher to, like, it's the main part of it is, like, to be recognized. Not in that negative light, I guess. But yeah, middle school, I'd say for sure, just because, yeah, it's an easy, not easy schedule, but the schedule is easier for a parent that's a teacher, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so my husband is mixed. His dad is black. His mom is white. Growing up as a mixed child in Southern California, is there something that you would, like, speak on, especially with this world literally gone batshit crazy, but, like, what is it like growing up as a mixed child?
Early on, I would say confusion is a good word, I guess, to describe it. I remember coming home in second grade, walking home, and some kid had called me a nigger, and I had no idea what that was. I was like, oh, okay, cool, man. Like, and I asked my dad, and he was, oh, my God, who said that? You know, he just overreacted, I guess. But I was just confused because my dad was black, my mom was white, and as I got older, it turned into, like, do I need to choose now? Like, do I have to choose a side? And then as I got into, you know, junior, senior year of high school, I knew exactly who I was. I embraced it. Enjoyed but having the best of both worlds, I would say, but definitely some confusion growing up, just because I always felt like I had to choose a side is what it was, once I realized, you know, races and all this kind of stuff. But early on, it was just, yeah, okay, whatever a nigger is, okay,
right.
You know,
right.
Like, got it. I'll be at school tomorrow. Okay. Like, who cares?
We're not laughing at that either. We're not laughing at that.
No.
Yeah. And his mom and dad, so his mom's white, his dad's black. And her parents did not go to the wedding because she was marrying a black man.
Yeah. My mom's uncle
walked
her down the aisle. Uncle Gene.
Yeah. Which is really sad. I mean, that was so long ago, but it's still even sad to think about that. And I just, it's so crazy because we talk about this all the time in our home, but like my husband had black and white friends. I had black and white friends, and growing up in Southern California, it's just so mixed with everything that, you know, like being here in Idaho, maybe if you were like in Idaho Falls, I could understand how it would be, you don't really know difference in races, but like when you're in more of a secluded area. So it's just so strange to think that a kid would even say that.
Yeah, I mean, and this was Azusa, California. And
like, where would a kid learn something like that? Obviously, his parents in the house, but that's nuts. And Azusa is
majority
Hispanic.
Yeah, Hispanic. Yeah, but I don't know. I guess it always came to sports is what it was. How our friend groups kind of formed was who do we play sports with?
Yeah,
and that's why it was this hodgepodge of different, you know, cultures and races, and none of us, I don't know, that's why I feel sports still is the great unifier, because it's just, you know, think about it, people coming together to accomplish a goal. It doesn't matter what your color is, if you can ball, you can ball.
Yeah, like think about like Jaron and Ramsey, the redhead.
Oh, yeah, we had the ginger.
Was Mexican.
We had the Mexican dude. We had the African dude. We had the
like
the
literally from Africa.
We had the regular African-American. We had the mixed guy, like. We had it all. Like,
yeah, it was a good, so crazy.
But yet, there was one common goal: was to play sports, and beat the other schools.
So, as having a, I forgot what I was going to ask on that question. It was going to be about a black and white. But do you think that the way that you see things, like from a black perspective versus a white perspective, do you think there was any influence from your parents, like, based on their race, if that makes any sense?
Not really. Like, I got to give them props on that. Like, it was never really a, hey, you're this, you're that, so this is how it has to be. Like, no, it was, you want to play hockey, you want to play football, you want to go to this party, you want to dance, you want to, it was never like a, black people don't do that, white people don't do that. Like, no, it was never, it was just live your life. Which is pretty cool. I guess now that I think about it, like, they never really, it was cool because it wasn't talked about. Like, race wasn't talked about. Like, it was, unless something happened at school or I asked a question, like, it was never a, well, your dad's black and this and that, or your mom's white and this and that. So I guess that was pretty cool.
Yeah. And we grew up in like very different areas of the city.
North side, south side. Wow. Twitter Boulevard, north, south.
So I grew up in like a nicer part of the city. And I wouldn't say there was no horrible parts of the city that we grew up in.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He grew up in a condo, right?
Yep.
Which there's nothing wrong with that. But we lived very
different.
But
it definitely,
lives, right?
You know, it shows, I guess, the income of what your parents are bringing in, I would say.
Yeah, and I always had people at my house. We always had parties, and there was never, it just was never like a race thing. My parents, I also grew up with two white parents. I mean, I guess my dad was Italian, whatever, but there was never like, oh, you have black friends or you have Mexican friends, or it was just so weird to think about now that like these kids are like this force of
that it even has to be
choosing,
brought up.
Yeah, like
that's the unfortunate part.
You're seeing race when before. That the whole point was to become equal, right?
Well, not even become equal. I think we're all equal. The whole point was to, hey, are you happy with your friends? Are you,
right.
Do they treat you right?
Right.
Do you guys all get along? Then cool, have at it. Invite them over, go play, go do whatever. It doesn't matter what the race is. Like, do you guys all like to do the same thing? Then go do it. Those are your friends.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. Amen to that. Okay. So, sorry, I derailed this a little bit. If you weren't a teacher, what would be, like, the number one thing you would ever want to do? Like, if someone said money's not an issue, I want you to do what you love, what would that be?
Are we talking like the ability to play or to do whatever any profession?
Want. Yeah.
Oh, I would have loved to have attempted to play in the NFL. I mean, that's,
yeah.
I can think back to Coach Podley saying during my, you know, after I graduated, I came back because to Benita to work out with him. He's like, I really think you should try and be a tight end. Like, you have the body, you have the frame. Like, I think you should try and do this. But once again, I was, you know, had living situation, didn't know where I was going to live for the next couple months. Like, I had to talk to my dad, who we didn't get along. There was just a lot going on that wouldn't allow me. I guess my support base wasn't there to allow me to go attempt this. I had one year of playing football, and it was my senior year that I actually completed. I was a quitter the first couple years, and I just had, dad issues. Any male that got on me, I was like, well, forget you. I don't want to do this. Like, I get yelled at home. I don't need this at school, too. But once I played senior year, it was like, cool. So I was playing and learning the sport at the same time. And then after that, it was graduation and then grow up, and I needed to. So, you know, it was join the Army pretty much. But, yes, definitely play in the NFL or attempt to play in the NFL, I would say.
Well, you just segued into my next question. Guys, he didn't know any of my questions, so this is perfect.
I didn't know I was getting interviewed. I thought we were just going to come on here and say what every 5 minutes.
Is that what you think Katie and I do? Katie, do you hear that? We need to have a conversation with this guy.
You guys just talk about Mormons and then say what every like 5 minutes, pretty much.
Stop. Travis is laughing at us. I see you over there.
I'm so sorry, Travis. I had no idea you're in the room too the whole time with Katie and Janessa for the past like 3 months.
No,
man, you're a good man.
At times he has been, at times he hasn't.
Okay, got it.
So speaking of the military, can you talk about your experience in the military? Like what you did, where you went, all of that.
So I joined the military because...
How old were you?
I was 19. Yes. Graduated in 2001 spring and kind of battled with, do I go to college? Do I not do college through that summer? Then my mom and sister moved to Washington. So it was like, oh crap, what do I do? I didn't want to move in with my dad. And I still ended up moving with my dad because I had nowhere else to go. That lasted from September to about December, where I finally was like in the Chaffey College parking lot with my man Irving with $94 to my name. Also, we were going to a party that night that you were going to be at, so I was super excited about that.
Didn't you get a new shirt or
something? I got a new turtleneck, and I thought I was the coolest guy in the world.
Turtleneck!
It was the sickest sweater turtleneck I saw in the music video. Not going to lie.
What music video?
Oh, just whatever. Probably Notorious B.I.G. at the time. Who knows?
He did wear turtleneck.
Yeah, I know. It's the one where they're walking in the club with P. Diddy and everyone. Yes. So I'm sitting in the Chaffey College parking lot thinking, oh, man, it's registration day. You know, I don't know how I'm going to do this. So instead, I took that $94 and went to the mall and bought a sweater instead of register to play. Try and play football. Irving went in, registered. I sat in the car, and then the next day walked in and saw the recruiter because I knew I had to get out of there. And then joined and then realized they have a delayed entry program, which means pretty much the recruiters, I feel, are just trying to pump their numbers up for the next month, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was December. He's like, oh, yeah, you can leave February 20th. I'm like, wait, what? No, I'm signed up now. I need to leave now because I had no job. I had no... Yeah. Nothing, no money, just it was bad. So then waited and then left. And then in the meantime, after signing up, I get a letter in the mail saying you've been approved for the FAFSA, the financial aid. So I guess I could have went, but it was too late. I had already signed up. So joined in February of 2002, went to basic training in South Carolina, Fort Jackson, for 10 weeks, then stayed there for another 10 weeks of training to be a light wheeled vehicle mechanic. And I wanted to be a crane operator. That was my first thing. I wanted to work down at the ports in Long Beach when I got out of the Army, taking those connexes off of ships and everything.
Which but we then, still want to buy one of those.
Anyways. Yeah, right. Yeah, tiny homes.
Mm-hmm.
Did that. And I was sitting in MEPS, which is the military entrance processing station. And the woman's like, oh, can't be a crane operator. And I had no backup plan. So she just straight up said, well, you can be a mechanic. There's an opening for that. So I just said, cool, let's do it. But I'm glad I did, because now the tools that I know, the tools that we used, I can change my own oil, all that kind of stuff. I think every male should know that stuff.
Yeah, our son says that mommy's the worker outer and daddy's the fixer.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I joined, and then after that, my first duty station was Fort Riley, Kansas. That was an eye-opening experience, just coming from Southern California to Kansas, never really been to another state. So the winters there were crazy. The humidity was crazy, but I met the greatest group of guys. I think you could, other than the great group of guys that we live with now. But Fort Riley, and then we left Fort Riley to go to Al Ramadi, Iraq, and then did our year deployment in Iraq, and then came back, and then I PCS to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, to be an instructor, and that's where I ETS. I got out of the Army in 2008.
After how long?
6 years active duty.
So when you went to Iraq, how old was Jalen?
Jalen, first daughter, was about 6 weeks old. She was born July 22nd, and we left September 11th, 2003. So yeah, that was tough, because we weren't supposed to go to Iraq. They told us we were going to NTC, which is National Training Center out in Barstow, and then we loaded everything up and said, oh wait, change of plans, we're going to Iraq. So first year was a wash for being a dad, pretty much.
Yeah, that's crazy. And so when you were in Iraq, can you kind of like explain the circumstances? Because you guys were, 2003 is when you went.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain like the living quarters and what it looks like? Because it's very different now.
Oh, man. So
I've seen pictures, but
the first push in was, you know, in the springtime, March time, we first invaded. Those guys had it rough. But obviously compared to just a couple years after that, to when we were there, we had it rough. We drove up from Kuwait. Everything was staged there. A couple days drive, and, you know, everyone was kind of like, this is it? Like, we're in Iraq? Like, you know, there was no action. Everyone was just thinking of what we had heard, you know? And then got to our camp in Ramadi, and there was just a bunch of blown-out buildings. It looked like the opposing forces, you know, military base, I guess. Had buildings, just no windows or anything. So we slept on cots with mosquito nets. What else? Had to poop in buckets. Had to pee in these tubes that were shoved into the ground. And ate MREs, which are meals ready to eat, for three times a day. We'd fight and wrestle over the Chili Mac. We'd wrestle over those, because I think those ones had the Skittles in it. And then we'd wrestle over the chicken. I think the chicken noodle soup was a good one, too. I think it was number 21. They were numbered, so.
Oh, my goodness.
You know,
I just want to try one to just taste it.
Yeah, it's not that bad. It's just, you just would choose, you wouldn't eat it if you had other food. So we had these bombed-out buildings and mosquito nets for the first, MREs, for the first about 6 months. And then they built a dining facility where we had normal cooked food. And then things slowly, just like amenities, started to pick up. We had internet access, you know, a couple months in, stuff like that. So it got a little better towards the end. But compared to now, there's Burger Kings over there and Subways and all that kind of stuff. So
isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's definitely changed.
So what about, didn't you say you guys just, when they moved on from the buckets of poop, didn't you say there was like an outhouse and it would get super hot out there? So
oh, yeah, we had privates out there stirring poop, pretty much. They would. They would dump diesel fuel into the pee/poop bucket and stir it and burn it off, pretty much. I myself never had to do that, because by the time we got there, I think it was the E4 specialist, so it was kind of up there, you know. We had been in the game for a year and a half or so, so our group was cool, but all the new guys that showed up had to do that. And then we finally got porta potties that we couldn't bring our weapons into, because it would get so hot you'd literally lose your mind in there, and all you're thinking about is getting out of the porta potty, trying to pull your pants up, because you're just dripping in sweat, you're slipping off the you're slipping off the toilet bowl. Like, it's just the worst. I had actually found a platoon leader's M16 and leader book in the porta potty, and like, to leave your weapon, to forget your weapon while downrange, that's just the biggest no-no. Like, you can lose your rank for that, you know, UCMJ action, all this kind of stuff. So I quietly found the leader's book. It had his name in it, and I quietly located him and say, hey, like, come with me. This, I have something for you, you know, instead of going to his platoon sergeant and say, hey, I got someone's weapon here.
Yeah.
Because he can get in trouble for that. So quietly found him, gave him his weapon, and went about my business. But yeah, life on, I think it was called Camp Junction City at the time. It was like right on the Euphrates River, I want to say. The Tigris or Euphrates River. One of the rivers was right outside of our gate. But yeah, it was a rough year.
So I've heard kind of some of the stories, but can you talk about like the worst memory you have? And I think that, I think I know. You don't have to.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's, you know, yeah, it was Moo. We were, what is it? So our guy group got split up, all the mechanics. I didn't know that. Which is probably the reason why I wasn't too bummed to have to go to Iraq with our group of guys. You know, Sergeant Clark was a bomber. He was in Korea, great leader. But Smitty and Giesbrick, Smith Sean, Sergeant Crocker, Sergeant Kleeman was a cool guy. We just had a good, Sergeant Ball too. Like, we had a good core of guys, so I wasn't worried about going, because, you know, we all had each other's backs. We were like, you know, they use the term brothers, but that's what we were. Captain Pendry was our commander, and she called us in behind our barracks, which was weird. She wasn't holding, you weren't supposed to hold like formal formations, because we'd get mortared and stuff, and we lost some CBs doing that, Navy CBs.
Tell them what mortar means?
A mortar round, you drop it in a tube that's at a certain angle, and it has a firing pin at the bottom, and you drop this round into it that fires back out at that angle, you know, the trajectory to go into our camp.
So the Iraqis would shoot these mortars into your camp.
Yeah, the insurgents would. Yeah, they had them in the back of trucks, because we had this cool technology that tracked where it came from. So we'd fire back out, but they got smart and would do it in the back of a truck and drive away real quick, stuff like that. So Captain Pendry holds a formation behind our building and just says, you know, I got bad news for you guys. And this was, you know, this was January. We'd been there since September and hadn't really had any issues, I guess. Other units had, unfortunately, but we as a unit were doing pretty good as far as injuries and not losing people. But Moo's platoon, his name's Travis Moohart, his platoon was Bravo Company, so they were down in Chaldea, Iraq, which was on Route Michigan, which was one of the deadliest routes, I guess, in country. And you know, he had his convoy had hit an ID, so Captain Pendry just called us all over and said, hey, I got bad news. Captain August was killed today, along with Moohart, and Sergeant Landry was the gunner. He had died a couple days later. And then there was one more, Sergeant First Class, I forgot his last name, who was also just killed, all killed. IED went off right next to their vehicle. And yeah, then we all went back to our bunks and just kind of laid there like, damn, is this really happening? Like, that's just kind of, yeah, that was the worst day there. And that's besides getting shot at and, you know, IED'd while driving.
Can you explain what an IED is?
It's an improvised explosive device. And the insurgents, the Iraqi insurgents, were getting really good at hiding them. They would take these Russian 155 millimeter rounds, which are just big, just rounds fired out of tanks. They realized how to like manipulate the blasting cap and then run a wire to like a car battery, and then once it receives that just low voltage, it'll detonate. So they would bury him in the ground while we're driving in our convoy. And then, you know, they're watching the convoy from afar with this cord or cable, you know, strung out through the ground or on the ground. You know, you can't really see it when you're driving a convoy. And then they would just detonate it while we're driving by. Or they'd daisy chain them together, which means there's like four and five combined all at once would go off. And it was always just reacting to this kind of stuff. But, yeah, it was a bummer. Just sucks. We still think about him. Yeah, that's why I wear the bracelet, just because, I don't know, I don't want to forget, I guess.
Well, okay, I'm sorry. I just opened up that can of worms.
Oh, it's all good.
I just think that is important for people to understand what it's like, you know, to be in the military when you are over there. And why I feel so strongly about people disrespecting the flag and just being assholes about it. So now everybody kind of understands. And if you could just tell them one more story that you told me about when you guys drove through that city in the dark, and then you guys were shot at. I don't know how to explain it.
No, all good.
Yeah.
So we had never like been outside of Ramadi, meaning, like a 20-mile radius, I guess. We had always done operations inside, so we were very comfortable with where we were. I can't say we knew the people or anything like that, but geographically, I was always intrigued with maps and where we are and stuff like that, which is huge. It's important because it means life or death in certain situations. We took a ride to Balad Air Base, which was a three-hour convoy, and Smitty and Giesbrick were in another convoy previously, like a week before. They had tried to take a different route. They had been ambushed. Nothing crazy, but just shot at, RPGs type stuff. And then so they turn around.
No big deal.
They turn around, you're right. They turn around and come back. So then, you know, they're trying to figure out a different way to get there. So we had to drive all the way down to Baghdad and then come right back up. But if you just think of like a big triangle, let's say driving from Boise out to, how can I put it? Either way, it was just a big triangle. We had to go down and then back up another direction, or a V, I should say, because we didn't really complete the triangle, you know? So a three-hour drive, we go to Balad Air Base, another place we had never been to. And then that night, we were leaving to come back, and a couple of our other division guys were like, oh, you guys are leaving at night? Like, why are you leaving at night? Like, well, that's just what we thought we're supposed to do, is just convoy at night. It's just, we have the MVGs, just an easier route, I guess, to avoid insurgents. So I'm sitting at the gate. It was my turn to gun. My vehicle had a 50 cal mounted on top, and I had a driver, Sergeant Klima, and we'd switch off on convoy, so it was my turn to be the gunner. And we're getting ready to leave. I'm sitting up in the turret, and my vehicle's really high, so I can see out over all the homes and buildings, and there's this Apache helicopter that's just unloading on something. Like, you can see the tracer rounds bouncing off whatever it's shooting at. So it's like, okay, cool, just an uneasy feeling. Like, we're going to go right through whatever that is. So we SP, we leave, we're in the convoy. We have to make a big U-turn in this intersection, you know, about 15 minutes out. Everything, once again, is fine, and then we drive under this walking kind of bridge, and one IED goes off, and then, everything was cool. We get on the radio, say, hey, everyone keep pushing, we're all good, and then about 10 seconds later, the daisy-chained IEDs went off. Two vehicles in front of mine, I can still feel the heat, and, like, from the blast to this day, it's just crazy. It's just, it's a very uneasy feeling, but all your emotions are, it's so like
fight or flight.
Oh yeah. But you've never been, I guess, so dialed in at one point. Like, that's all your focus is right there at what's happening. Nothing else is going through your mind. And they immediately start firing. There is, you know, small arms fired to the right. They were firing at, this clay hut to the left. So my driver yells up, like, they're on the right. So I, you know, lock and load, start firing. And I have a 50 cal, which is just a very comfortable weapon to be behind when someone else is shooting at you, just at the ability of what it can do. And we're firing back. Gets quiet, and they start, you know, I adjust fire and start firing on this home that they're firing at, and then pause, and then my mind starts going, oh man, there's people behind us now. Like, there was a homes to our right and left, but where these IEDs went off was a break in the homes, just an open field. And I still just vividly remember this whole scene, and it was in the middle of the night, and our MVG goggles allow us obviously to see what we're looking at, but the pieces of vehicle that have been blown up were on fire, so it was kind of playing with the MVGs, the lighting of it, and the smallest light can look so bright that it kind of blurs the vision. So I'm frantically lifting my MVGs up and down, up and down, up and down, because it's hard to see. I'm spinning in my turret. At this point, I'm crying. I'm sweating because I'm thinking, oh my God, am I going to die? Like, I don't know if that's the strongest mental aspect of it, but I was still composed, I would say. Like, I wasn't just firing my weapon at houses left and right. I was definitely looking at all sectors by spinning around because we didn't have the smartest people in our platoon, so I was worried about what's behind me. I had my 249 down to my side if I needed to get out of the vehicle, and I did not need to get out because then everything had calmed down. QRF team is on its way, and which is a quick reaction force. There's Bradley fighting vehicles that were on the way, which was a very cool feeling, knowing like, okay, someone else is coming to help us out. But the shooting and everything, it was done. It was dead silent. Then we had to drive through the kill zone, set up a landing zone for the injured personnel. No, thank God no one was killed that night. But there were some injuries, throat shrapnel injuries. Specialist Moody, the gunner, was knocked out unconscious. His face was all kind of badly bloodied. He lost his ring finger, I believe. But everyone pulled through, which was good. Here we go. Now we have to drive 2 more hours home. There was no like, hey, you guys are good, we got you from here. It was, now we still need to finish the mission and get home and drive. And it's just an uneasy feeling knowing that can happen 10 more times on the way home. You know, there's no one there to bail you out. You are the Army, I guess. So that was the mindset of it. And then the next night we had to go right back to that spot and get the vehicle that was blown up. So it was, you definitely have to be prepared for anything. And that's, I'm glad I went at the age I did, because I was naive. I was, that point I was 20 years old and just thought, yep, I'm invincible pretty much. And I'm glad I went at that time, because mentally it was just, I don't know. I was in it, I guess.
Yeah, that's crazy. So when someone gets hurt like that and you guys had to go all the way back home, how do they help them? You have medics with you that like help bandage them up? I mean, can you even stop?
We have combat medics. Everyone has been the majority of the people in the convoys have been to combat lifesaver school. So you can bandage someone up, apply a tourniquet if you need to, just the very minimal things. And it's, are they breathing? And are they breathing? Yes. Can you stop the blood? Yes. And then those are the two, when you think about it, those are the two most important things to keeping someone alive. And they called in a Black Hawk, which was really cool to see because it was real life situation. And it was pitch black at night, but the Black Hawk has this infrared kind of light that shines down from the bottom of it while it's landing, and it lights up everything. But when you take your MBGs off, it is pitch black. You can't see anything. Excuse me. There's no lights showing. There's nothing showing to the naked eye. But the second you pull your MBGs down, it's like the sun's out. It's the coolest thing to see. They flew in, took the injured personnel out, and Sergeant Ski and Moody, they had been flown off. And then Chief Hunter was inside. Clausen was inside, and they just hopped into our other vehicles and just kept on pushing. I actually had Chief Hunter sitting in between my legs while I was standing on the turret for the rest of the convoy home, because we didn't have any other spots in the other vehicles.
Wow. So, okay, remember we were in Yellowstone and I told you we could come back at night and get those night goggles to see the animals, because we didn't see, like, we saw... I'm totally derailing again, but I was just talking about I wanted to go back to the night goggles or whatever. I don't even know what they're called. What are they called?
It's NVG, night vision goggles. So yes, they're pretty much night goggles.
Right, but you said that I wouldn't be able to see the animals because it just shows like heat, right?
No, those are like infrared. You would be able to see the animals with both. It would be easier with like infrared type goggles because you can see the body heat of the animals. Oh. The NVGs, it just shows different shades of green and it's pitch black outside. Yeah. So yes, you probably still see animals, but if they're far away, it'd be kind of hard.
Maybe I just watched too many movies.
It's all good.
I don't
know. All good.
Okay. So I wanted to get into just kind of how we met and your, like from your perspective.
Okay.
Our story.
We're taking it back to like high school?
Yeah. Right? From the very beginning. Okay.
Let's see. My sister and you were friends, kind of just school, like acquaintances, I would say. And I had seen you at school. You were a senior when I was a sophomore, but I think freshman year, like I noticed you, yes, but then sophomore year when it was like, okay, who's the thick white girl, pretty much, with a cool personality. And then, yeah, so it kind of started in high school and then blossomed, I would say, towards my senior year. You had already graduated. We would just see each other here and there, I would say. And there was always this weird chemistry. And you had a boyfriend. I had, you know, my girlfriend at the time, now ex-wife. And it just was never the right time, I would say. But yet there was still this weirdness every time I'd come back into town. And we would keep our distance. But I remember one night you guys were coming back from the club or whatever it was, and I was already at my buddy's house, and my buddy and his sister were our friends, and my buddy goes, yeah, Janessa's on the way back, and I'm just kind of like, oh, man, she's going to be here. Like, it was just always this awkwardness, and then in 2007, I had already been separated, and for some reason, you still were on my mind, and this is 8 years down the road after we had graduated, and rest in peace, my buddy Ramsey. I texted him and said, hey, do you have Janessa Gross's number?
And that was my last name, my maiden last name.
Yes. And he said, yeah. And then I just remember saying, hey, what's up? It's Alan Dade. How are you? And this was a couple days before Father's Day, 2007. And I remember you saying, oh, yeah, you know, well, let's talk a little bit later. We got my dad this volleyball net. We're going to go swimming right now, you know. And that was it. And it was like, okay, cool. And then since then, we had kind of started talking every day since then. And yeah, we started long distance relationship, which I'm glad we did because I thought you were a totally different person than what, when we started talking, it was like, wow, she's completely different than what I had assumed. And yeah.
Like, what did you assume?
Just this, because you were always at the river. You were always out. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, she's this party girl. She's going to be crazy. You know, that was just kind of what I had assumed. But then speaking to you, it was like, oh, wow, it's not. Okay. She likes to obviously social, have fun, all that kind of stuff, but not necessarily that, oh, the party chick, you know, am I going to be able to tame her type feeling, I guess. But I still to this day, I'm not as 100% comfortable with just how social you are. Like it's just new to me because if you know my ex, you guys are the complete opposite.
Well, I do know her. We grew up together.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I just, you know, speaking to the podcast world.
Oh, all the peeps out there.
Yeah. But yeah, that's how we met, started dating, and then.
So would you say you chased after me? Get this on record,
not.
Travis.
Absolutely not.
Going to take tally here.
Oh, no way. You know, you were the senior. I was a sophomore. So it was just kind of like, whatever.
So it was whatever.
Cool.
Okay.
She keeps trying to ask for my celly.
Oh, fine. We didn't even have cell phones back there.
My pager number. My pager number. Will date us right now.
Oh my gosh. That's
but
funny.
Yes, I was chasing, and yes, I'm the one that reached out. So I guess if you want to put it that way.
Well, I mean, the feeling was mutual. It just was not. It
was never the right time.
Yeah, and then it was.
Yeah, it's just crazy how it works.
Yeah.
Just seeing your. You know, at your 18th birthday party, I was so excited to be there. Just, I could care less who was there as long as you were there. And just to be able, I don't know, to get that invite. It was just.
I have some good pictures. I can post it on the podcast.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Instagram of Alan in his tight pants.
Yep.
It was a 70s party.
They ripped in front of her parents and her grandparents.
But I got a video of that moment when they ripped. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so the one last question, and we'll wrap it up. What would be your biggest dream? Like, not career-wise, just your biggest dream. If someone said you have no money to worry about, you can do anything you want, what's your biggest dream?
Ooh. I don't know. That's, like, we're talking, I don't know. I don't want to ask too many questions about it, but at this point, this day and age, you know, to have this big, beautiful ranch-style home, which we kind of have, but on, you know, like the only thing that comes to mind is just Montana for some reason, and this big, beautiful plot of land.
Because we love the show Yellowstone.
Yeah, with cows. I really like cows.
I know you like
just cows. The nicest, just cows. Not do anything with them. Just get them and let them grow up and go out and talk to them, and then when they die and get more cows.
Oh, I'm sure Andy would love that.
I know, right? He's like, oh my God. Happy birthday, Andy, by the
way. Yeah, this is Andy's birthday.
Yeah, just with our family and raising them on, like, I wouldn't say a farm, but just out there a little bit, but still close to town to have some sort of social life and have the kids go to, you know, a regular public school. And obviously both of us not working, since you said money is on, you know, is not in this, both of us not working, but doing something that kind of gives back, I guess, or like, I'd like to do like youth, like sports training and just making better athletes, stuff like that. Have this really cool, like indoor.
Well, don't give away too many ideas.
I know, right? Just this really cool indoor, like, complex to where I can, like, kids know in the summertime or whatever, when the wintertime, too, because it's indoors, have them come and we'll do soccer training and football. Just not necessarily sports-specific, but, you know, just create good athletes, I would say. But, yeah.
Get kids moving.
Yeah. Definitely both of us not working, have this big giant house that's paid off and own cows and you have your plants and all that kind of stuff. But I'd say it's a pretty good dream.
I love my plants, so... Yeah. Yeah, about that. Okay, guys, so I think we hit our, time frame, and I asked a lot of questions, but thank you so much for coming on, Boone.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, he does have a good voice. If you guys want him to come back on, we can maybe bring him back on.
Let me know. I do.
We got to look at our schedule. I got to
let me know.
I got to consult with Katie. But if you are listening on Apple or Spotify, please give us a review, like us, and follow us on Instagram, Say What Podcast 2021.
On the gram.
Yeah, thanks for coming, guys.
I appreciate it.
Bye.
That's it. All right, time's up, people. Hope you enjoyed yourselves as much as we did.
Yeah, and come find us on social media, on Instagram, Say What Podcast 2021. Give us a follow. If you have questions or topics you want us to cover, you can slide that right into our DM.
Slide it in like butter, baby.
And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review.
Cheers.